Turn your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 8. Deuteronomy, chapter 8. We'll begin reading in verse 1. The whole commandment that I command you today is you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply, and go in and possess the land that the Lord swore to give to your fathers. And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, and your feet and your foot did not swell these 40 years. Know then in your heart that as man disciplines his son, the Lord your God disciplines you. So you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God by walking in his ways and by fearing him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There are a lot of people that hear the word discipline and usually put it in a context of something negative, that it is something that amounts to punishment. It is something that is involved in trying to correct something that's been wrong. Well, I want to approach it from a different angle, and that is, which I think also encompasses the idea of discipline. It's a matter of something, I guess you'd say, instructive for practical purposes. Yet I want to tell you a story about someone that you may or may not remember. And as I tell the story, you probably can remember some details about it. A few details, not all the specifics. But there's a guy by the name of John Walker several years ago who was an American defector. He went to live in the land, or I should say the country, of Afghanistan, and became to be part of the Taliban, which was an Islamic political movement group. And there was an article that was written about him, or maybe not as much about him, but about his parents in the year 2002. And these are some of the things that were stated about John Walker's parents. And when you consider what he was that he did, it said in the article that his parents turned away from the responsibility to guide and discipline their son and gave him healthy, quote-unquote, doses of open-mindedness and tolerance. There's a man who wrote another article about him in the Boston Globe who said, Mr. Walker is responsible for his own behavior, and he will pay the price the law requires. But his road to treason and jihad did not begin in the country of Afghanistan. It began in Marion County with his parents who never said no. The failure to discipline, to give instruction about what should be done, and at the same time maybe correction of a wrong way or error of something that was false. And with that being said, I think what goes on with what happened to Mr. Walker, especially that with regard to his family, helps remind me a little bit about some of the difficulties that you might see in Christians. And in some cases, what you might see in the church as a whole is a lack of discipline. And I want to ask you this question. Do you believe that it's really essential that the best thing that we need to do is to make affirmation and to affirm people, or is it best that we discipline them? If you were to take a student in school and for all practical purposes give him or her a lot of affirmation, affirm him or her and what it is they do, they might feel okay and safe, even though they got the wrong answer, consistently getting the wrong answer. If you continue to affirm them, then maybe that makes them feel okay because they got the wrong answer. But in a workplace, if you took, let's say, a manager of a particular store or business, is affirming the employee the thing that a manager will do if the employee doesn't show up consistently over the next 7 days, or if they come in late, and or if they are not dressed appropriately to come to the job and do the services that they're supposed to render while they're at the job? Is the manager supposed to be affirming that action, or is he supposed to do something to discipline that? To give maybe instruction or maybe correction? What is it that boss or manager is supposed to do? What's the best way to resolve that issue? What should be done? And I think we would understand that you just can't let things that are false or wrong, error, sin, you just don't let that go by as if to say, well, let's just affirm those people. Let's just make sure they know that they have a self-image that needs to be held up. Let's just make sure we recognize the fact that they are part of creation. Let's just make sure that they're accepted. That kind of thing. Is that what we're really supposed to be doing when it comes down to the idea of discipline? Not really pointing to the discipline, but just affirming the fact that they're okay. Everything's okay. And I say that to look at the case of what you see here in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 8. When God says what he does in the first 6 verses, and really we're going to look a little bit more into this chapter all the way through to the end of the chapter. When God looks upon the people of Israel, now first of all remember they are his people. Does he look at them and say, I want you to know something. You are not as bad as everybody else is. You're not as bad as all these other nations. I want you to know that you're a pretty good nation. Is that the thought process that God does in delivering this information to the people of Israel? He just gives them very simple in verse 1. He says, just live by the rules. Follow the commandments. He says in verse 1, that which I command thee, you shall observe to do it, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land. Just follow the rules. Go by what I'm telling you to do. Observe this, and it will be beneficial to you, and you will live. And they're his people now. They're his people saying, but he doesn't just say, you're just a good group of people. I want you to know that. He says, follow the rules. Now, in the process of looking at rules, what's so important about these rules? What's the purpose of giving these people, which is his people, these rules, which are as a matter of discipline? What's the point? What's the matter of all this? Well, the first point that you will notice in this, in verse 2 and specifically, is that this is to humble them. To humble them. And verse 16 even indicates the very same thing, where it says, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which the fathers knew not, that he might humble thee, and that he might prove thee to do this good at the latter end. It's to humble them. It's to make them understand that they're not the ones that's most important in this case. It's God that's the most important one. Self-image was not the problem with the people of Israel. They had a lot of self-image. They got out of the land of Egypt. They started complaining about the fact that they didn't have what they needed. They started getting to the point that they felt like they could build something that would signify to them who God was. And they did that in Exodus chapter 32. They built the golden calf. Self-image was not their problem. Not at all. They had all kinds of self-image. And when he gives them these commands, it's to remove this pride that the book of Proverbs chapter 16 verse 18 talks about leads to destruction. And it's also meant for us to understand that all the things that God specifies to us, these rules are for our good. In other words, it's to humble us too, like Romans chapter 12 verse 3. It's not good that you think more highly than yourself than you ought to think. It's so that you think about what's necessary in the eyes of God. You know, when you look at violence in any place, whether it's school or whether it's home or work, and you look at abortion and you look at unfaithfulness, you look at people who dress immorally, all that's not a matter of they've got a bad self-image. They've got a real good self-image of who they are and what they want to do. And what God gives to them in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 8, as well as previous to this, is just to humble them, to let them know it's not about you that's most important. It's about what God wants you to do. If that is, they want to do what God wants them to do. Now, if they want to do what they want to do, they're going to skip this altogether and go out and do whatever they want to do. Why is it that these rules were so important? Not only to humble them, but also to help them see if their heart would really obey what God said to do. Verse 2. Even in this text it says, "And thou shalt remember all the way which Jehovah thy God has led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble thee to prove thee to know what was in the heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or not." If you're going to follow exactly what I want you to do. I don't know how many of you parents here in this audience have a lot of rules at your house. I hope you do. Yet there's probably some rules that contain a word like no, and there's also some rules that contain the word like yes. Why do you give those rules? In other words, let's say, for example, you've got a 16, 17-year-old child that comes up to you, and they want to go out on a date. And you say yes. Why do you give them the opportunity to go out and have that date? Is it because they're of the age of dating in your mind? Or is it that you're going to see if they can really tell time? That if you set down a time that says 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, you want to see if they're followed through with the rules, and you'll see if their heart will obey 12 o'clock, if they know what 12 o'clock means. And could it be that you're giving them this opportunity and you're saying yes to this, and you're giving them this opportunity and giving this command, not only with the time but also with a behavior. Say, this is what you're supposed to do and this is how you're going to act. You're giving them this information so that you will see whether or not they will follow what you ask them to do, if their heart's going to obey. Why give the Ten Commandments? Why give all these specifications as to what you're supposed to do to worship? Why do you give your people this? To see if they'll obey. It's a matter of discipline. To see if they'll follow what it is I'm showing them is most important. They may think in verse 3 that the most important thing was them to be fed with manna, given water to drink. But he said, I want you to know something. It's not as much as important thing in life that you're given bread to eat. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of Jehovah. It's just to see whether or not you will obey. That's the second reason. The third reason is when you look in verse 5 and verse 6, it was to show them that, yes, you are my children. You are my children. And this kind of goes back to way before this time. It really goes back to the beginning of time when God placed within man his image and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. And ever since that time, God's given people rules, things to follow, to prepare them to see if they will obey, and get them ready for eternity. Here's God showing his children certain things he wants done, and also at the same time giving them warnings. To give them an understanding that they are to obey him. They are not the children of a lot of other gods. They're only the children of one God. Same thing's true with you as parents. Your children are not the children of somebody else's parents. Only yours. Same thing's true with God. As a father would do what he could to let his children know that you belong to me, and I'm giving this information to you so that you will know that I belong to you and you belong to me. That's what any father would do, and that's exactly what you see in Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter, the 12th chapter, you will notice something that's stated in verse 5, verse 7 regarding what it is that God will do, and he will, as it states in this passage, chasten those, scourge those whom he loves. In verse 5, you have forgotten the commandment, or the exhortation rather, which reasons with you as with sons. My son, regard not lightly the chastening of the Lord. Don't faint when thou art reproved of him whom the Lord loves. He chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. It is for chastening that you endure. God deals with you as sons, for what son is there whom his father does not chasten? So you know why God's doing what he does. That's why you know whatever father does, what he does. Verse 11, the benefit is all chastening seems to be for the present, not joyous, but grievous. It afterward yields peaceable fruit unto them that have exercised thereby even the fruit of righteousness. There's a benefit to this. Benefit to the on the part of the father to show the child he recognizes the fact that it's his child that he's doing this to. And it's also a benefit to the child to know that this is given to you for your benefit, that you'll grow up to be who you need to be. And you won't be like everybody else's child. And you do whatever you want to do. Now we got the third reason. And there's a fourth reason. Why are these rules given to them? Why are these commandments and instructions given to these people? It's a matter of prevention. We're going to see what we can do to prevent something from happening that might happen to other people if they don't follow the instructions, if they don't consider the rules. As children, they needed guidance. God knew this. God understood this. And as a result, he talked about how important it was that they do this so that they will not forget him as their God. You see that a little bit in this chapter, verse 11. Beware, lest thou forget Jehovah thy God and not keep his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes which I command thee this day. If you bring a group of people, as he is doing through the wilderness, to bring them to the point of being in a land flowing with milk and honey, one of the things that he warned them about and told them about is don't be so, I guess you'd say, attracted to everything that you're given in this land flowing with milk and honey. You're going to have all these goodly houses, verse 12, herds, flocks, silver, gold, all that's going to be multiplied to you. He is trying to get them to understand, number one, do not forget God, because you're going to find yourself having received all that prosperity. And God knows if they find themselves so attracted that they're going to forget him. Therefore, all this discipline is given to you to prevent you from looking at all of that and saying, that's more what I need than anything else in the world. In other words, it's physically what you see as a God, not something you cannot see. Therefore, if you cannot see it, then it's not a God. But if I can see this, then that's what's really going to be my God. That's what's going to really direct my thought and pave the way of life for me. Yet this is what God wanted to prevent from happening. That's why we're told so much and exhorted so much. We got to live by faith, not by sight. Like the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5 talks about. And in this, you will notice that he's not only trying to prevent them from forgetting him, he's also preventing them from understanding your power is not as great as you think it is. Notice this in verse 17. Lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth. Even in verse 19. It shall be, if thou shalt forget Jehovah thy God and walk after other gods and serve them and other worship them, I testify against you this day, you shall surely perish. He's trying to prevent them from, number one, forgetting God in verse 11. He's trying to prevent them from thinking that their power was greater than the power of God and that they didn't need God anymore. In other words, if they forgot God, they're going to drift into independence. And God doesn't want that to happen. That's why he wanted to show them these commands, humble them, prove them to see if they would obey. Rather than them thinking, we don't need God anymore. We've got all the information we need. We've got everything we need to follow and go by in life. And that's the first violation of rules. It's control. The first violation of rules is control. Who's going to control whom? Is it going to be your way that controls what you do, or is it going to be God's way that will control what you do? That's all part of discipline. And God knows that. I want you to see the power that is in my hand that has given you this wealth, not the power in your hand that's got you where you are today. And also, you will notice, as we stated in verse 19, one of the things he wanted to prevent from happening to them is to keep them from being comfortable with everybody around them. He talks about it in verse 19. You walk after other gods, serve them, worship them. I'm testifying to you that this day you will surely perish. As the nations that Jehovah makes to perish before you, so shall ye perish. Why had all these other nations perished? They were following all these other gods. If they decided they wanted to find themselves compromising what they believed, getting rid of all the discipline, getting rid of all the information that God wanted, then they could control their life and do what they wanted to do. But to know this, the consequences of what would happen to them would be the same thing that happened to all these other nations. They would perish. They would perish. That's why all these rules are given. And when you turn over to the book of 1 Corinthians, for example, and the story is, I guess you'd say, given to us in a real short version in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 to verse 13. And really in verse 1 through about verse 11, you've got the story of the people of Israel going through the wilderness. And they're wanting to do what they want to do. Even it says in verse 5, howbeit with most of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. And they were given all this information to discipline their life, but they just threw it all away. And you find in verse 7, verse 8, 9, 10, and 11, all the things that they did. All the things that God was trying to prevent from happening, they went out and did it. Thought they were smarter. Thought they had the power. They forgot God. They compromised their values, compromised their principles, and started negotiating with everybody and everything around them. They eased up on the morals, and therefore they found themselves in condemnation. And here's the interesting lesson for us, verse 11. Now these things happen unto them by way of example, and were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages are come. And he doesn't stop there. He says, wherefore let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. And he doesn't stop there either. He says, there has no temptation taken you, but such as man can bear, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation make also the way of escape that ye may be able to endure. From all that God wanted these rules to do, and then the people of Israel who were his children that defected and decided to do what they wanted to do, now the lesson is for us to understand the value, the importance, the need for us to be disciplined, for us to learn what discipline's all about. Now then, let me just give you something very quickly that are the four D's to discipline that you will see in the lives of the people of Israel. You will see even in your own life, and hopefully you will learn from this to the point that you may make necessary changes to know the value of discipline in yourself. First of all, it's the matter of decision. All these examples here that I've got in Hebrews 11, Joshua 24, Acts 2, Acts 5, 2 Timothy 4, and Proverbs 3, all of them involve decision. We're going to read the one in Proverbs chapter 3, verse 1 and verse 6, but if you notice in the one in the Hebrews chapter 11, that's Moses making a decision. Choosing to suffer ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Joshua 24, Joshua makes a decision about he and his house will serve Jehovah. Acts 2, the people made a decision about 3,000 of them to be Christians that day. Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira, they make a decision to lie. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, that should be 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 10, is with Demas, and that is he's the one that decides he forsakes the Lord and loves the world. Every single one of these people made a decision based upon a discipline. Something they learned, information they received, instruction they were given, and they made a decision. Then you have what is found in the book of Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3 verse 1 says, my son, do not forget my law. Let thy commandment Let the heart keep my commandment for the length of days and years of life, and peace will they add to thee. Let not kindness and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them upon the tablet of thy heart. So shalt thou find favor and good understanding. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to be accepted by people. Everybody wants to have good understanding in the sight of God and man, he says. Trust in Jehovah with all thy heart. Lean not upon thy own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct thy paths. When you make the decision to follow God, then you've got the second thing, and that is direction. You've got direction. That's what parents do in Psalms 127, verse 4, when they pull those arrows back, and then they let those arrows go, they're pointing them in a direction. What direction are they going to go in? Whatever direction you point it. In other words, if you want your child to grow up to be like a Daniel, you don't point the arrow, which is the children, in the direction of an Ahab. That makes sense. Therefore, whatever direction you point them in, that's the direction they're going. With the discipline you give them, they're going in that direction. Every decision, when it is made, is going to show a direction of which someone's going. Every decision. Every decision. Now, there might be a question about the direction of which you're going in, but there's no division at all about the direction. You know where you're going. With the decision you made, you know the direction you're headed in. Now, you may think that you're going north when in reality you're going south, yet you're going in the direction in which you point. The decision that you make, regardless of how deceived you are, you're going in that direction. And that's so important with any decision that's made, that we will go in that direction. You cannot divide the direction. You cannot find yourself thinking, well, I'm going the right way, I think. You got to know where you're going. You got to know exactly where you're going. Every decision has a common characteristic, and that is it's going to go in a direction. The discipline is to decide that we're going to follow God, and he will give the direction. The decision to follow God leads us to the point of getting the right direction. Think about it from the standpoint of Matthew chapter 6. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 19. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust consume, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth consume, and where thieves do not break through or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The decision made of where you want to go, that's the direction you're going. That's what you're going to do. And he points in one of two directions here, either treasures upon the earth or treasures in heaven. Now, you may think that you're going to heaven, but the direction is more so what you're doing on the earth. But whenever you decide, that's the direction you're going. With every decision that is made that points us in a certain direction, it needs, you could use two words here, discernment or wisdom. It needs discernment as to what we're doing. Guidance. We might say. It needs someone to give information that will help us make the right decision, that will point us in the right direction. I would say that there's probably been times where all of us have had people give us information. And from that information we were given, we made a decision that pointed us in a direction. And we found out that the decision we made that put us in a certain direction was not the right way. We found out it was wrong, it was a mistake, it wasn't true, all those kind of things. And what do we do? What do we do? We just keep going the wrong way? Or do we decide, number one, that we had the wrong information, we made the wrong decision, we pointed ourselves in the wrong direction, and now we've got to turn everything around? Or do we just keep on going? Well, better luck next time. Better luck next time. It's not that bad. We're not too far off. We'll get there. Do you see God anywhere affirming someone who didn't use wisdom, getting the wrong information, and finding themselves going in the wrong direction and say, well, I know you made a mistake. It's not that bad. It's not as bad as somebody else. You're a pretty good person, that kind of thing. Does he just affirm them, or does he say, you got to change your life? I mean, that word repent comes out. Does he say, change things now? Well, sure, he says change. He didn't say keep on the same path. You'll get back around to it. Don't worry about it. It'll be okay. When you look in the book of Hebrews chapter 5, there are some people, interestingly enough, that have the right information. They have the right information, yet they don't apply it. They're given the right discernment, the right wisdom, but they don't make the right decision. And they point themselves in the wrong direction. And you notice what it says in verse 12, for when by reason of time you ought to be teachers, you have need again that someone teach you the rudiments of the first principles of the oracles of God and are come such as need of milk and not of solid food. In other words, just like you see in verse 14, there are some people that get the information, find the discernment, they get the information, and then they make the decision and they point themselves in the right direction, either it being good or evil. They know the difference between the two. And some people don't know that. They don't have the discernment yet. And therefore, their decisions are bad, and their directions are wrong. And you see the value of this. Sometimes the discernment comes as a result of us not applying, or I should say maybe doing the opposite of what we know we should be doing. For example, if we know that the sexual fulfillment in marriage is where it should be in that particular place, and then we go outside of it and commit fornication? Should we stay there? Or is wisdom going to tell us to get away from that and go back to where we're supposed to be? Wisdom is going to tell you, information of what God says is going to tell you to turn around and repent and go back to where you're supposed to go with your husband, with your wife. And you're going to find yourself going in the right direction. If a person lies and knows they are lying, when they find out the consequences of that, number one, when they find out that lying is not true, what will you believe that person will do if they're interested in being disciplined by God and following this course that leads to the right kind of action? They're going to decide this is wrong, and they're going to turn around, and they're going to go in the right direction. They're going to go toward God, and they're going to listen to His truth, and they're going to follow it. It's amazing to me that there are some people, as this text points out, that know it. They know what decision to make. They know what direction they would go in, but they refuse to do either one. They refuse to make the right decision. And here's an interesting thing, too. The fourth D to this idea of, we would say, discipline, is disciple. Disciple, New Testament term, is a matter of learner. It's a matter of someone that is going to be a follower. And here's something that's very interesting about this. The disciple is one that may listen very attentively to everything that's stated. This idea of disciple is going to be the origin of discipline. More so, though, this person is not going to only listen to what's stated. They're probably going to be following someone that they admire. Because this person is following a certain discipline, and they're going to follow right in the path, right step by step to what this person's doing. Because they admire them so much, they follow everything this person does. Their attitude, their beliefs, their behavior, whatever they do, they're going to follow that person because they admire them so much. And when they do that, that becomes a discipline for them. The disciple is a learner of someone they admire. That's why you find in the book of Matthew chapter 10, in verse 24, these words. Because in Matthew chapter 10, verse 24, it talks about Jesus, and this is the way that it's stated when it says, a disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his Lord. The disciple is going to follow what the teacher teaches, giving the disciple the information to make the decision, pointing him or her in a proper direction, all because they have discerned that this is somebody I really do admire. And I appreciate it. So much so that that person who believes this and admires this person and will be that disciple will go so far as to suffer if that person suffers. Whatever they do. Matthew chapter 16 bears that out in verse 24. If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. He'll go wherever the one is that he admires. That's exactly what you see in the scriptures. I think it's really something to understand that we often receive our discipline from the one we admire and the one we follow. All right? Now the decision is yours. You want to be a disciple. All right? What that means is an individual who's a disciple is one that will listen to what? The information, the discernment. And they'll look at that and they'll say, I want to be a follower of this person. I want to do what they're doing. I want to be like them. Be like them. And we talk about that all the time. Be a light of the world. And then when you look at what this person is asking me to do, you have no problem in deciding. You will immediately decide. And then you know of what direction you're going in because the person you're following is going in that direction. You want to follow right behind them. And you follow them without any hesitation. Whatever they ask you to do, you'll do it. And that's exactly what God was asking of the people of Israel. And that's what Jesus was asking of anybody that wanted to be his disciple, to be my follower. And that's exactly what we're asked to do in the scripture, to be one who is disciplined. The only thing is, we have to be the one to make a decision as to what we want to do, who we want to follow. That's the real bottom line to the idea of discipline. Just following and doing what God asks you to do. And let him be the one who's in charge of displaying, showing, distributing all the blessings. Let him handle all that. You just follow along, right along with what he wants you to do. Being a Christian is a difficult decision. But if all the information is there of what you need to do to hear and believe and change your life and confess in Jesus as the Son of God and be baptized in the water, rise up, walk in newness of life, if it's the one that you admire most is the God who gives you that information, you'd have no problem in making that decision and going in the direction that he wants you to go in, knowing that he'll take care of all the blessings and you will become to be his disciple. Therefore, do what's right while together we sing this song.